This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Completely different. And the next hour, he's already discussing the project with the Malachi Ashoris. Why does he discuss with the Malachi Ashoris? Because it's Derech Eretz, not because their opinion would sway him one way or another, but it's Derech Eretz. Begimel, on the third hour already, Konas Ofro, he already gathered together the dust, the sand, from which he was going to make Odom. Baraviz, Gevoloi, the fourth hour, he put it together. Behei, at the fifth hour, Rekomoi, he did all the finishing tasks, Chachas. Bavov, Asul Goylim, in the sixth hour, he made it into a form. The Zion, on the seventh hour of Rosh Hashanah, 5,743 years ago. Nopcha Boi Neshoma, the Ribbono Shel Shalom breathed that first breath of life into Odom Harishon. That's the seventh hour of Rosh Hashanah. Beches. So we should just work out more or less how it's going to work out during the day. So it's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon or so, just when we're coming out of shul. That's the anniversary of the creation of Odom Harishon. That was the moment that Odom Harishon got up and he walked around. And we should remember that when we come out of shul on Rosh Hashanah, to feel recreated. We should feel ourselves as new, as if the Ribbono Shel Olam has just put that breath of life into us. Beches hichnisa legan, the eighth hour he brought him into the Garden of Eden. What was he doing for that hour between the seventh and the eighth? It took him an hour to take him into the Garden of Eden. So we're told, Rashi tells us in the Chumash, that where it says, Vayikach, so Odom, Vayinicheo beGan Eden, that the Ribbono Shel Olam took Odom, Rashi says, Vayikacheo bidvorim, he persuaded him to get into Gan Eden. So you see that he wasn't in Gan Eden to start with, he was actually persuaded to move into Gan Eden. Why did he need persuasion? Gan Eden doesn't seem such a bad place. What would you say? Has anybody got any ideas? Why did he need persuasion? Sorry? He was also perfect at that stage. I think he was scared of him. Scared. He knew that there would be at least a mitzvah there, and he rather didn't want to come to temptation. He was happy outside the garden. He would rather have forgone the beauty and the wonders of the Garden of Eden, not to be in the position where he knows that he might not be able to stand up to it. But Tesnit Stave, at the ninth hour, he was given the commandment. So why didn't he eat from the tree in the eighth hour? He had a whole hour to eat from the tree before the Ribbono Shel Olam commanded him. Anybody got any ideas on that? Firstly, his wife wasn't born, so he said there were no Torahs yet. Yeah? That could be. Also, there was no Isur yet. You know, things taste a little bit better when they're also, when there's no Isur, made no difference. It only, the wonderment of why you're not allowed to eat from the tree only started after it was forbidden. Maybe that's what it means, I don't know. But Yud Ova, the 10th hour he was over. So Chava must have been born already. At least by the 10th hour she was certainly born. All happened on one day. But Yud Aleph Nidon, at the 11th hour he was judged. The Yud Beis Yotso Bedimus, the 12th hour, 6 o'clock at night, just as we're getting ready to start Ma'ariv for our second night Rosh Hashanah, that's the time that Odom Harishon left the Garden of Eden. Bedimus, the Mephoshim say, means with chesed in a sense, lucky that he was still alive. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Odom, Ze Siman Levonecho. The Ribbono Shel Olam said to Odom, as he took his suitcases and he was walking down the road, leaving Gan Eden behind him and feeling very, very depressed with his wife next to him, the lost opportunities, can you imagine that the feelings of that moment, all the future of mankind, lost, gone, because of a mistake. And the Ribbono Shel Olam comforts him and says, Zeh siman levanecha, this will be a sign for your children. Keshem she'omadeto lefonai bedin hayom hazeh, in the same way as you stood before me in judgment this day, ve'yotzaso bedimus, and you went out with chesed, I treated you lightly, kach osidin bonecho lamoi lefonoi bedin b'yom hazeh, so your children will in the future stand before me on this day, ve'yotzin lefonoi bedimus, and they will be released from me in Rosh Hashanah with chesed. Amosai, when will that be? Bechodesh Hashvi, Beechod Lechodesh, on the seventh month, on the first day of the month, that's next Shabbos. So Rosh Hashanah has its roots far earlier than any other Yom Tov. Pesach is for Yetzias Mitzrayim, which happened much later. Shavuos is for Matan Torah, which happened much later. Sukkot is for Yetzias Mitzrayim, which happened much later. Rosh Hashanah has its roots in the first day of human existence. That's the root of Rosh Hashanah. The cause of Rosh Hashanah, the cause of celebration, the cause of celebration, not in the sense of just joyous celebration, but of observance, the cause of that is in the first day that the world was created. There was an inherent Rosh Hashanah experience already in the first day. And Reb Nosson Zvi Finkel, the author from Slabotka, takes this medrash as a basis to learn something about the nature of Rosh Hashanah from the experiences of Adam HaRishon. After all, that was our first Rosh Hashanah. If we want to understand a little bit more about Rosh Hashanah, let's understand a little bit more about what caused that first Rosh Hashanah. What was it that he did that was so wrong? Why was he punished in that way? And so on. The consequences of what he did were enormous. There's probably never been any human action that has had consequences so dramatic and so far-reaching and so terrible as the consequences of that action of eating from the Eitz Hadas. Whatever the wrong was, that's another discussion. One thing we see, that the world has never recovered and never will recover until ultimately Mashiach comes one day. Adam HaRishon himself lost Gan Eden. That wasn't just he moved from one place to another. I don't know where Gan Eden is. I think that Gan Eden was all over. It wasn't in one place. That's where Gan Eden is, and outside of that is not Gan Eden. Gan Eden was a status of being rather than a geographical place. And he lost that forever. Gan Eden is gone. Adam HaRishon Adam HaRishon, Chazal tell us, had the stature of being able to have vision from one end of the world to the other. He could encompass and include everything in his vision. And that was taken away from him. His stature was diminished. He became an ordinary human being that couldn't see that much further than any other outstanding human being of that time. Death was introduced. Decay was introduced. Degeneracy was introduced. Sin was introduced. Guilt was introduced. Punishment was introduced. All the things which have made the world such a difficult place to live in. All the tzoras that we have today and that we've had for the last 5,742 years started off there. We wouldn't have had one of them. There wouldn't have been one pogrom. There wouldn't have been one Hitler. There wouldn't have been one Ahasuerus. There wouldn't have been one Amalek. There wouldn't have been anything. There wouldn't have been a Paro. The whole thing would have been different. There wouldn't have been wars. There wouldn't have been disputes. People would have got on in a different way altogether. Life would have been completely different. All this is because Adam HaRishon ate from the Eitz Hadas. And it's not so clear why, what the terrible thing was. He didn't have Eira. God told him not to do something and he did it. The kind of things that we do, unfortunately, day in and day out. We're disobedient. God tells us to do things and we don't. He tells us not to do things and we do. And we're not treated with that same harshness. What was it really that Adam HaRishon did, which was so very serious? There are two interesting midrashim on this that I would like you to see. The one is in the again Midrash Rabbah in Parsha Yutes, the end of it. Omer Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish said, Adam HaRishon loy nitrad migan Eden. Ad Shechoraf the Gidev. Adam HaRishon was not thrown out of the Garden of Eden until he committed an act of blasphemy. That's why he was thrown out. If it weren't for the fact that he committed an act of blasphemy, he would not have been thrown out. It's very difficult to understand. Firstly, we don't see anywhere in the Torah where he committed an act of blasphemy. Where does he do it? And secondly, is that why he was thrown out of Gan Eden? Not because of the eating.
Omer Rabbi Abba, v'ochalti ein k'tiv kan, elo va'oichal. Says Rabbi Abba, the word used is not the woman which you gave me. Adam says, ha'isha asher nosota li. The woman whom you gave me, she gave me the fruit, va'oichal, and I ate. But he uses the converse of vav.
the correct grammatical form, it could have said ve'ochalti en da'et. That's the past tense of the verb to eat. Ve'ochalti. But he doesn't. He says va'ochal, which is also means and I ate, but it's using a different form. Ochalti va'ochal. That has a double meaning to it. There's a double implication, says Rabbi Abba. It's fascinating. He's telling God, not only did I eat, but va'ochal, from the word yachol. I ate and I'm still around, God. I'm still alive. It wasn't quite as you said it would be. Still here. There's a note of victory in his words. Ochalti, the woman you gave me, gave me the fruits to eat. Ochalti, ochal, and I was able to eat it and withstand it. It's a note of victory. And on that, Rabbi Shimon ben Lokish says, Adam Arishon lo nitrad migan eden ad shechorach begodav. That had in it notes of chiruv begiduv, notes of blasphemy. To stand before the Ribbono Shel Olam moments after he said to you, don't eat. Bad enough that you ate, but to come along and imply va'ochal, and I was able to disobey you, the Ribbono Shel Olam. That was the reason that he was thrown out of Gan Eden, which gives a whole new vision onto the whole story. That he disobeyed the Ribbono Shel Olam. No, one can fix that up. That he ate from the Eitz Hadas, God could have forgiven that. But that he said, Va'ochal, and I was able to disobey you, and with pride he says it. That not. For that you've got to go out of Gan Eden. One day maybe we'll have a share on that all together, because it has some other interesting side ideas as to what the nature of the Aveira was, why Adam HaRishon did it, why Gan Eden was incompatible with him after he'd done it. But there was an aspect of the whole decision in Adam's mind was, is the human being going to have the capacity to disobey God or not? And Adam HaRishon wanted the human being to have the capacity to disobey the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's why he ate from the tree. Because he felt that with that capacity one could become far greater than one could come without the capacity to disobey the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so he says with pride, Ochalti va'ochal, I disobeyed you, Ribbono Shel Olam. I did it with pride. Almost like the first time a child disobeys its parent. Or in the old days. Nowadays, the first time a child disobeys its parents is probably 2 minutes after it's born. The parents don't require obedience anymore as one of the modes of behavior of a child. So the child doesn't even experience that thrill of disobeying a parent. You know, it's like all these things that just become too easily available, one doesn't appreciate them. So disobedience is something which is so easily available, and the look and surprise of modern parents when a child actually obeys indicates the extent to which children have been denied the opportunity of feeling that thrill of the first time that they tried the parent on and they won. That feeling of victory, which is hinted at here, that the Adam HaRishon felt proud at the fact that the human being was so great that he's able even to disobey the Ribbono Shel Olam. There was that sense of a thrill. But the Ribbono Shel Olam responded badly to that thrill, or to the expression of that thrill. Ba'ochal, that's chiruv begiduv, that you can't say. What does it mean? Does it mean that that's what Adam meant? God, I've beaten you. Chas v'sholom. Not possible. That's not the meaning of the Medrash. If one knows who Adam HaRishon was, and one can understand and appreciate what it felt like to have been created and formed by God's own hands, and have been placed there and had communication and dialogue with the Ribbono Shel Olam in an untouched, unblemished world. Is Adam HaRishon going to start already with that kind of talk? That's not what the Medrash means. That wasn't Adam HaRishon. He used the perfectly normal grammatical sense. Sentence, Aisha Hashem Nusateli, He Nusonali Va'ochal. But there's a subconscious, deep, deep down, something comes to the surface by his choice of words. We discussed last week that people are much deeper than we think. And it's more difficult to know ourselves than we think. If you listen to the tape issue from last week. And that even emotions can be so terribly false and misleading. The important thing to understand, though, is what Rabbi Saul Salanter said well before Freud said it, that there's a subconscious side to the human being. And that we don't really know ourselves until we know what's right deep inside. And that only sometimes comes to the surface. And we discussed last week how the world thinks that if you act emotionally and you act with feeling, then that must be genuine. And we showed how that's completely nonsensical. It's exactly the opposite. The more emotion there is in it, and the more feeling there is in it, the more chance it is that you're feeling yourself or you're feeling somebody else. The more you can be sure that there's something wrong, that there's something fishy. It's when a thing is thought out that you know it's genuine. Here we see some of the deepest parts of Adam HaRishon coming to the surface by his choice of words, not by what he says. What people say is not the real them. They say, sometimes even the greatest of people will say what they feel needs to be said, not always what they feel like saying. How they say it, that already tells a little bit more about what's going on deep inside. The tone of voice, the choice of words, the punctuation, the grammatical structure. And Chazal have the perception to be able to note that by Adam's using the word va'ochal rather than va'ochalti, deep down in Adam, there is a little sense of pride at having beaten the Ribbono Shel Olam. And for that he's thrown out of Gan Eden. You know, if that's the kind of punishment that is brought about by something so deep under the surface, that means that all the rest God's prepared to forgo, that wasn't so serious. It's bad that he ate from the tree, but all that God could have forgiven, could have been handled. But that deep feeling of pride, that not. So we see that the Ribbono Shel Olam is punishing not the action so much. The Ribbono Shel Olam is not punishing the deed. And he's not even punishing the thought. He's punishing something deep below the conscience. Deep down. Something which even Adam HaRishon might not have recognized. The Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Nun Hei, the Malachim, the angels even asked the Ribbono Shel Olam, why did you give death to Adam? What did he do so terrible? Even the Malachim, even the angels couldn't notice exactly the depth of what Adam HaRishon had really done. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam notices that deep in his deepest subconscious there's a touch of pride at having been victorious over God. And that's what he gets punished for. So what chance do we have standing before Rosh Hashanah? If a deep subconscious negative feeling arouses such wrath on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, expulsion and rejection, what chance do we have to look over the past year and say, look, Emirat Hashem, we should have a good year next year? What gives us that chutzpah? To be able to think that we've managed to come through this in a way that we can stand on Rosh Hashanah before the Ribbono Shel Olam with clean hearts. I'm not even talking about the deeds. The deeds, okay. All sorts of things we do that we regret doing, that we've done, that we regret having done. And the ways of doing tshuva one can repair, but if we're talking about things which are so deeply subconscious, how can one even do tshuva if one doesn't even know they're there? And those are the things that the Ribbono Shel Olam responds to so powerfully. It's depressing, Poshet. It's absolutely depressing. Just look at one day, take one day and think, can I stand before the Ribbono Shel Olam and offer this day and say, look, Ribbono Shel Olam, take this day as an example of what I really am. Forget the other 364. Just take this one and look at it. Do any of us really have one day where we can be sure that our feelings are free of any of these kind of subconscious nonsenses? It's not possible. There's another medrash. There are many like this, but we'll just do two. Vayered Hashem lirois esoir ve'es hamigdal asher bonu bnei ha'adam. And Hashem came down to see the city and the building which the men had built. This was a Tower of Babel. Later on in Bereshis. No. The Midrash is worried by the use of Asher Bonu Bnei Ha'adam that human beings had built. Omer Rabbi Brachi v'chima noema Bnei Chamayo Bnei Gamalia. Is there a Havamina? Might I have thought that this structure, this skyscraper was built by camels and by donkeys? But it has to tell me that the building which the human beings built. Who else built buildings? So what's the Torah trying to tell us in Bnei Ha'adam? Ela Bnei De'odom Kadmot, the sons of the man, of Adam with a capital A. Not just the sons of man, meaning human beings. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to come and see the building which was built by Bnei Ha'adam, the children of that Adam. In other words, we see already that the Ribbono Shel Olam finds the roots of the Tower of Babel in Adam HaRishon. Mo Odom Harishu, Achar Kola Toivo She Osisi Imoi. Omar, Ho Ishu Asher Nosato Imodi. Odom Harishu, not all the goodness I did to him. I brought him into the world, I put him into Gan Eden, and I made a wife for him. I looked, I noticed he was missing something. He didn't know he was missing anything really. He never had it. I noticed he was missing something. I worked out exactly what it was that he was missing and created it for him. And after all that goodness, Omar Ha'ishu Asher Nosatu Imodi, he says, when I accuse him of eating from the tree, he blames it on the woman. That's alright still, that you blame it on your wife, no, that one can forgive. But Asher Nosatu Imodi, those are the words that sting the Ribbono Shel Olam. That woman that you gave me, God. Kach Shin Mem Shono Midor HaMabu HaDor HaFlogo. So also there are 340 years from the flood to the Tower of Babel. And then it starts. In other words, only 340 years and they've already forgotten that they were saved from the flood. That they do avodas, they do things, but to try and overthrow the God who saved you, the Ribbono Shel Olam who brought you out of the flood, him you want to overthrow, only 340 years later. Here we see again the extent of the damage which Odom Harishon did, but here what did Odom Harishon do it with? Again, choice of words. Ha'ishu asher nosatu imodi. All the time Odom Harishon is getting blamed for little things that he said which indicate something not right deep down in him. Ha'ishu, okay, you're right, your wife gave it to you to eat, you didn't have to question. What kind of a husband it is that whenever his wife dishes up, he says, well, is it kosher? What hechsher is it? Where did you buy it? What kind of husband is that? What kind of wife is that? What kind of marriage is that? There's something very wrong in such a situation. You either trust your wife or you don't. If you don't trust your wife, better go eat somewhere else. And if you trust her, then it's her business where she got the stuff. So Chava dishes him up with some food, he's entitled to eat. That's not what he's being criticized for. He's being criticized for those last words, Asher Nosatu Imodi. Just the way you said it, Odom Harishon, did you have to add those words? Blame it on God. What do you think I gave it to you for? To cause you to eat? I gave it to you because you were lonely, Nebet, because I felt sorry for you, and you throw it back at me as if I did you harm. And that introduced into the world the absurd possibility of being Kofui Tova, of not appreciating. And I say an absurd possibility because when you think of it, it is absurd for a rational being to feel lack of appreciation to one who saved his life. Well, it's completely irrational. You wouldn't be here without him. So whatever he did, so the woman caused you to eat and that caused you to sin, etc., etc., but you wouldn't be here without him. Why are you blaming the Ribbono Shel Olam? And the people of the Tower of Babel, you're angry with God, you're miserable, you're cross, you say what you want, but he saved you. You would have been dead. The whole of humanity was wiped out. You were saved by him, and he you want to overthrow. The British people after the war, they have the throwing out Churchill. Where would you be without that man? Kick him out. Had enough of him. Show him a bit of appreciation. It's absurd. It's absolutely mad. There's no rational basis for it. And it wouldn't have existed in the world if it weren't by Odom Harishon's choice of words. Isho asher nosata imodi. The woman whom you gave me, that introduced into the world the sickness of kefuye tova, of people not being able to appreciate even when their lives are saved by others. And we see also the concept that 340 years is not considered by the Torah too long a time to remember. How long do you have to remain obligated? Somebody once asked me. No, so A does a favor to B. How long does B owe back to A? You see here that 340 years is not considered too short. Even 300, the Torah doesn't see much difference between 340 years and a few hours. It's the same thing. One has to have a bit of historical perspective as well. One has to understand. One has to appreciate that one owes things not only to one's contemporaries who have helped one out, but one owes things sometimes to indirect people who may no longer live and who may have lived many hundreds of years ago. One has to feel the Hakoras HaTov to a Rambam, to a Shulchan Aruch, for making things accessible to us which otherwise would have been lost. to our Ravino and Ravashi for editing the Gemara, for our Rebbe for making the Mishnah for us. We still today have to feel the sense of Hakaras HaTov for these people. What would we have if it weren't for them? We would have nothing. All the Torah we've got, every word of it is thanks to them. It would all have been forgotten by now if it weren't for them. And every word we learn is thanks to them. Every step of progress we make is thanks to them. How often do we think to our minds, to ourselves, an appreciation for our Rabbi, for our Rebbe, an appreciation for our Rambam, for our Shulchan Aruch, for our Ramo, for later people, earlier people? We don't think like that. We like to forget, we like to feel that we've done it all ourselves. And we feel very embarrassed by being obligated in a sense of appreciation. So here again we have a repetition of the first type of medrash, in a sense that Odom HaRishon, there were terribly dramatic and far-reaching results just from a choice of words, from the way Odom HaRishon said what he said, which revealed a deep down feeling that wasn't right. And again one begins to ask oneself, if that's the consequence of a wrong word, if that's the consequence of a man as great as Odom HaRishon putting one step wrong in choice of words, not even in the concept of what he said, just in the choice of the words he used, what chance do we have after the 300 and how many years of days are there in the Jewish year?
365.
No, in the Jewish year. 348 or something, isn't it? 352. What? Sorry? 355. After 355 days of babbling away, what chance have we got of coming out feeling able to take responsibility for what we've said for the 355 days? And when one wrong choice of words has such effect 340 years later, that the Ribbono Shel Olam blames Adam for an event which occurred 3 centuries later after his life because he chose words incorrectly. What chance do we have? People talk about being moral without being religious. They don't know what morality is demanded from the Torah, of the Torah from us. What it is to choose your words carefully, and the extent of the wrong choice of words, how far that can go. How can one be moral to this extent without a Torah? It's not possible. And how can we face the Ribbono Shel Olam this coming Shabbos with anything, with any claims at all? All we can do is stand there and say guilty. Strike us down, do what you want. There's nothing we can do. It just creates a feeling of total despair. The Gemara says in Yom Daf Yutes, the Dibarta Bom, says in the Shema that we read every day, twice a day, the Dibarta Bom, you must speak in matters of Torah. Says the Gemara, Bom yesh lecho reshus ledaber veloy bidvorim acherim. You have permission to speak in Torah and not in other matters. Omar Rova said, Asoch sichas chulin, a person who speaks sichas chulin. You know there are different levels of conversation, of talking. There's Torah. And Torah includes anything that one says which is meaningful and true. It needs to be, those are the two conditions it needs to have. It must be meaningful and true. That could be classified as Torah. Then there's sichas chulin. Sichas chulin is something which is not particularly meaningful, just ordinary talk. Then there is dvorim betelim, unnecessary talk. Sichas chulin is just a secular talk. You're talking about things which are not meaningful and true. But dvorim betelim is you're saying, you're talking nonsense, not harmful nonsense. You're not swearing, you're not telling dirty jokes, you're not talking lashon hara, you're not telling lies. It's just that you, so what you're saying is it's nonsensical. That's dvorim betelim. And then there is dvorim asurim. One says things one isn't allowed to say. So you've got Torah, divrei chulin, dvorim betelim, dvorim asurim. 4 levels. Torah is the highest level. Chulin is the second level. On that second level, says Rove, hasach sichas chulin. If a person talks, that second level, things which are not true and meaningful, things which are not Torah, over be'aseh, he transgresses a positive commandment of the Torah, shenema v'di bar tabam, bam v'loy bedvorim acherim. It says you must speak in Torah and not in other things. Amad points out that Rashi learns Dvorim Acherim as Tzichas HaYelodim VeKalus Rosh. Rashi learns the Dvorim Acherim not so much as what we have defined as Dvorim Divrei Chulin, but one step lower, Dvorim Betelim, nonsense talk and childish talk. And to do that is an Issur D'Oraisa, it's a prohibition of the Torah. Rav Acha Bar Yaakov Omer Over Belav. Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says a negative commandment of the Torah is also transgressed. So it's serious business. That to say something which is nonsensical, which is meaningless talk, is an Issur under the prohibition of the Dibat Abon Veloy B'Dvorim Acherim. And there's an amazing Gemara in Chulin where the Gemara says on Daf Peites, Mo umanusoi shel odom ba'olam hazeh. What is the skill of life in this world? What is the most important skill to master in order to come through olam hazeh successfully? It's a fantastic question. What is the professional skill that a man needs? When we talk about umanus, we're talking about professional skills. What do you have to really excel at to make a success of this world? Answers the Gemara, Yosim atzmoi ke'ilem. It's the skill of being able not to talk. That's the most important skill there is to acquire. There is nothing more important to coming through the experience of life in this world successfully as the skill of being able not to talk. Making yourself as if you're dumb, unable to talk. It's an amazing thing because the art of silence is not a negative thing. It's not talking in the sense of doing nothing. Out of not talking, holding yourself back from saying something, knowing when not to talk, is such a skill and so important. Says the Gemara, Yochel Atzla Divrei Torah, an amazing Havamina. Maybe then one shouldn't even discuss Torah, one shouldn't talk at all. Not even Torah should one talk. Talmud Loimad Tzedek Tadabrum. So the Pasuk says, Tzedek Tadabrum. Right things, righteousness, correct truths. Tadabrum, you're commanded to speak, you must speak. And if it wasn't for the Pasuk, the Gemara would have been left with the conclusion that you mustn't speak at all. So dangerous is speech, so destructive is it, that you would be better off if it weren't for the Pasuk, not talking at all, not in Torah, not in Chulin, just keeping quiet all the time, than talking freely. What a word can do, it's unbelievable how much damage talk can do. I don't think there's anything more powerful that the world has been able to conceive of. If you think a nuclear explosion is powerful, nothing like a word. Nothing. A nuclear explosion, if it's big enough, can destroy the world. That's a lot of destruction. But a word can destroy an Olam Haba as well. A word can destroy not only this world, but a world can destroy an Olam Haba as well. You can take a person right out. What damage has been done, it's too amazing and too tragic to see, particularly in the educational field. Ask them to come in and learn some Torah. Particularly in an educational world, when a person's gone all off, you suddenly find the person's doing well, and then all of a sudden problems. And this is not managing, and that is not managing, and he's lost his interest in this, and he's lost his interest in that, and he's getting depressed and miserable. And you start searching. What caused it? Where did it come from? When did you go off? When did the problem start? The back of it, a word. Somebody said something. Just one word. What can be destroyed? A thing that can take years to build. One's own life, somebody else's life, an institution, a business, an empire. A thing that can take years to build can be completely devastated just with a word. The right word at the right time to a vulnerable person. And how skillful we are at finding the vulnerable person, at finding the point of his vulnerability, and of shooting the dart right into the wound, just getting it right. And then all you need is one word, and you can destroy him totally. Husband and wife relationships, parent-children relationships, teacher-student relationships, interpersonal relationships. Totally devastated by some mean, cruel individual, not knowing how to look after his own mouth, not knowing when not to talk, that's all. We're not even talking about how to talk, that's already a very advanced skill. How to choose your words, what to say, that's difficult to expect from people. To know how to talk, that's not possible to expect. But just to know how not to talk, how to keep quiet, that's all, just to shut your mouth. Don't say anything. Leave him alone. If only people could learn that, what could be saved? How peaceful the world could be. How everybody could get on with their own business. How everybody could achieve, could develop themselves, develop one another. Free from that interference. And so devastating is it that the Gemara has a Havamina that we should rather not talk at all, not even in the Vreto. And it's only because of the Posuk of Tzedek Tadabrum that we're entitled and in fact instructed to talk in Torah. And in fact here in this Gemara we have the key to the avoidance of depression over the next week or two. Because on the surface the Gemara's Havamina, the Gemara's initial assumption is correct. If the power of speech is so devastating, if we mostly talk badly in any event, mostly we're not careful with our choice of words, mostly we do damage when we talk. And whenever we do a little bit of good, wrapped up with the good is a lot of bad. In that case, we're better off not talking altogether. So why does the Torah instruct us to talk in Torah? The answer is the following. That the only way one can undo the devastation of talk is by countering it with positive talk. That's the only way one can do it. To withdraw into a shell and not to talk at all doesn't work. That doesn't help. Doesn't help you and doesn't help others. The only way that the devastating effects of speech can be counteracted is by divrei Torah, is by positive speech. Somebody's sitting at your table and he's talking nonsense. So what are you going to do? You're going to withdraw and you're not going to talk at all because you don't want to participate in a nonsensical discussion. So he carries on talking nonsense. What have you gained? What happens if you switch it around and you start talking Torah? Now define again, when we talk about talking Torah, we're talking about saying anything which is meaningful and true. What happens if you start talking sense instead of nonsense and you change the conversation? You're able that way to displace all the nonsense and all the distractiveness. If somebody's about to talk Lashon Hora and you say, hey, don't, keep quiet, unlikely you'll have much success. Firstly, it's unlikely they'll keep quiet, and if they manage to keep quiet, they'll keep quiet until you've gone. And then, either they will look for somebody to say it to, or if there was anybody else present, the moment you've gone, they say, what were you going to say a few minutes ago when you were so rudely interrupted? It becomes all the more attractive to hear what was going to be said, and you can be quite sure it will be said. So you won't hear it, so you've saved yourself at least. But you haven't saved the Lashon Hora. But if instead one's able to start talking Torah, the moment that the Lashon Hora is about to start being talked, you're able to start talking about other things, more meaningful things. You can save the whole thing. It's possible to save. When somebody is saying something undermining, when somebody is saying something destructive, change the subject into something constructive. Bearing in mind that when we see how damaging the power of speech is, that's not just how damaging it is. That's how powerful it is. And if the power of speech can be so extreme in a destructive sense, it can be at least as extreme in a constructive sense. And if we see that Moshe, Odo, by saying something with a bad choice of words could affect a generation 340 years later, how much more so can one affect generations 340 years later with saying something good and saying something positive? And if Lashon Hora is the worst Aveira that there is, don't forget that Divrei Torah is the greatest mitzvah that there is. And if every time one talks nonsense it's an Isser, don't forget that every time one talks Torah it's a mitzvah, and a very, very great mitzvah. And every word, every concept of Torah that one expresses is another mitzvah, and another one, and another one, and so it goes. And so one says to oneself, you know, how can one stand before the Ribbono Shel Olam and Rosh Hashanah with a clean mouth? Just feeling that what one said during the year is going to allow oneself to come through Rosh Hashanah unscathed. The answer is, as I've said before, if you're a person, let's say, who spends an hour or two a day learning Torah, speaking in Torah, discussing Torah, you've got an awful lot of credit. It's not easy to undermine the effects of an hour or two of Torah a day. if you're working out that every word is a mitzvah far greater than all the other mitzvahs of the Torah, and if you work out how many words of Torah one can speak in 2 hours, there's an awful lot of credit that needs to be wiped out before you're at square one. There's a mind below square one. If one's involved in meaningful talk during most of the day, if one's able to find that what one is saying, what one is talking about, what one is communicating most of the day is meaningful and is true, how powerful that is, and to what extent that stands to our support when we're standing there in Rosh Hashanah. We mustn't think only of those unnecessary and unpleasant words that we've used, the destructive words that we've used. When we stand on Rosh Hashanah, we must also think of the words and words and the hours and hours that we have spent in Torah, listening to shiurim, participating in shiurim, learning, reading, discussing, and not only informal Torah, but also generally talking about things that are meaningful. And that's what the Medrash, that's what the Gemara here tells us. Tzedek tadabru. Your only way of being saved from the ill effects of speech is to counteract it with as much tzedek as possible. Talk, talk, talk. But talk divrei Torah. Talk things that are meaningful and things that are true. And that applies not only to the power of speech, but in general to the past year and to Rosh Hashanah. We need to spend the next few days as far as possible ensuring that when we stand before the Ribono Shel Olam, we have some kind of credit in our accounts. Something. And it's not impossible. We did in the Lady Shur a few weeks ago, when Shaul was sent to wipe out the Amalekites. Vayomer Shaul el Hakeni. Shaul said to the Canaan. They were people, descendants of Yitro, who lived among the Amalekites. Lechu suru redu mitoch Amaleki. Before they came to attack the Amalekites, they warned the Keni to clear out. Pen oisifcho imoy, unless I will destroy you together with them. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to destroy you together with them. Ve'ato osiso chesed in kol b'nei Yisrael ba'aloisam imitzrayim. Because you did kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up from Egypt. Vayosar Keni mitoch Amalek, and the Keni departed from the midst of Amalek. And says the Radach, Bechim kol b'nei Yisrael also chesed v'aloi lo also chesed eloi Moshe. What is this kindness which the Keni did that has saved them centuries later, saved the entire nation? What it was that Yitro, their old grandfather, invited Moshe to dinner one evening. That was the chesed. And that act, one dinner party, is able to save an entire nation centuries later. You know, we sometimes talk ourselves down into depressions about appreciating the power and extent of averas, of doing wrong. And they're powerful. And the extent is far-reaching. But we don't always feel the power and the extent of doing good and doing right. One act of chesed, and what chesed was if Yisrael was a wealthy man? And Moshe for dinner. And who did he think Moshe was? Moshe was a down-and-out Egyptian, he thought, on the run, who saved his daughters, who helped his daughters. It's such a big thing to give him a dinner in return. And for that, his entire nation, centuries later, is saved. And did they do no wrong? They live among the Amalekites. What kind of people can they be? Not the greatest. Doing no avera, sitting there living among the Amalekites, tzaddikim, not likely. It doesn't matter, everything they did wrong, whatever it was, they were saved because centuries earlier their grandfather did something right. And that was enough to save them. For that, Am Yisrael has to show the Akoros HaToyv, Am Yisrael has to show the gratitude to respond by saving them. We can't wipe you out, it can't be done. And so as we stand the week before Rosh Hashanah, and we need to try and fill up the bank account a little bit, it's not very difficult. It's not difficult to do a few mitzvahs in the last week that can by far outweigh anything wrong that we've done. What we've done wrong needs to be repaired. You can't just cancel the one out with the other. What we've done wrong, we need to do tshuva for. But still, we're able to build up, even in 1 week, by acts of chesed, one could build up tremendous resources that can stand one in good stead as the Ribbono Shel Olam looks down on us and decides what kind of a year are we to give these people next year? What is it going to be like? We don't know. We stand with a big question mark over the next year. And it's all going to be decided within the next 20 days. Less. The next 17 days. The whole of next year is going to be by building up the bank balance a little bit. Just by building up the account and making sure that in it we've got things that we can at least say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ribbono Shel Olam, I don't know what we've done bad. We've done a lot bad. Chatanu, Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu, the whole lot. But we did some good things too. Isn't there anything redeeming in us? And an act of chesed goes a long way. Goes a very long way. One never can appreciate how far the action goes. I've said before, you're nice, you just greet somebody nicely one day, puts him in a good mood, makes him do something better, which makes somebody else do something better, and the chain effect can be absolutely infinite. How much more so when it's a greater act of chesed than just greeting him nicely. When it's an act of caring, whether it's an act of concern, whether it's an act of empathy and an act of sympathy. And on that I have been strongly requesting in the Beis HaMidrash over the past few weeks that there is very much more interpersonal interaction in that sense. That there's a lot more consciousness of this. That there's a lot more interpersonal relationship, caring, entertaining. It doesn't have to be lavish entertaining, just being together, getting together. Understanding that there are a lot of lonely people that need places to be. And even people who are not lonely need friendship. Even people who are popular, got friends, but still, they need friendship. And they need companionship. And they need people with whom they can talk, people with whom they can share things. They need the ability to relax with people. They need to feel, as we were discussing at the Shalashuddhas, that they're among people who care about them. All that is something which is needed. That's something which requires a lot of effort and a lot of work. But something the rewards for which are infinite. That you can save a nation 3 years, hundreds of years later, because you had one old man to dinner. What only can be done with small acts of chesed. And one act of chesed brings a response, and the response brings a counter-response, and so it goes backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. But one needs to do it. And I said it one of the men's shiurim, and I said it the ladies' shiurim, and I say again tonight, that please know and understand that what we're trying to do is to create or recreate Jewish normality. That our sense of normality should not be the normality we see outside in the street when people walk up and down and make a noise. That's not what's normal. What's normal is what the Torah holds as normal and what used to be normal for the thousands of years of Jewish history. It is normal that around your Shabbos table you have guests. It is abnormal not to have guests. It's weird not to have guests. It's crazy. It's sick. That's not a Jewish society. It's all gone wrong. Yeah, you can want a quiet Shabbos by yourself occasionally. Go for Shabbos, no guests for Shabbos. Every family has its own needs too, which need to be looked after. But the norm, you must know that if that's what you need, it's because you're sick, because you're tired out, because you've been overdoing it. Because for 6 weeks at a time, you've had 50 people around your table, Friday night, Shabbos, Shalashuddhas, breakfast, lunch, supper, you're worn out, you need a Shabbos on your own. You've got to know that it's because you're worn out, not because that's normal. And oh, this Shabbos, we're having people to dinner. This Yom Tov, we're entertaining people. That's not how it is. No big deal to have people for dinner. We once did an important Zohar, it was to do with Sukkot, where the whole raison d'etre of eating altogether is because you have people at your table who need it. It's that that turns it into something spiritual and something social and something meaningful, not just something animal, of shoveling food into your stomach because you need it. It's the guests around your table that make it into a spiritual action and that make it into a social action. And that is the norm, no great deal. And you've got to see yourself, if you look around your table and there are no visitors around your table on the Shabbos, you would say, what's happened today? What is it? Something seriously is wrong. Are we sick? Are we getting old? Are we tired out? What's happening? The norm is, you sit around your Shabbos table, 3 people, 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, it makes a difference. And if you can't afford it, cut out one course. So you have less meat or no meat. If you can't afford that either, you have fish instead of meat. Much more important to have the people than to have the meat. Much more important. So you don't serve wine, you serve grape juice. So you don't serve whiskey at all, you serve water. No Coca-Cola, it's healthier as well. That doesn't matter. You can always find a way to come out. That's never an excuse. The only excuse is sometimes one's posh or tired, sometimes one just cannot handle people. Good, so you take a break. But with the knowledge that it's a sickness, one's going through a down period, and it needs to be reverted, it needs to be made good. And what a mitzvah, what a chesed. I'm talking, it's a mitzvah and a chesed even among people who have busy social lives. How much more so is it a mitzvah and a chesed to pick up to the phone to somebody who feels isolated, to somebody new who's just moved into the area and is trying to find their feet never, and don't quite know anybody yet, and it takes a while and it takes a time. And they need a bit of response, they need a bit of community involvement, they need to feel comfortable and at home. How much more of a mitzvah is it to pick up a phone and to invite them over? And if it doesn't suit them this Shabbos, can we make it another Shabbos? When does it suit you? People sometimes, out of sensitivity and out of refinement, turn down an invitation. Very nice of you, thanks very much, but it's quite okay. And the tendency is, okay, no, good. So we did it. Yotze, finish, tick them off the list. It's not like that. It needs to be built on. It needs to be worked on. And the other way around too. The people who need to become involved in the community need to make the effort as well to get to know the community, to do chesed that way around, to develop that kind of relationship and that kind of involvement. It's just limitless. It leads to who knows where, to what kind of relationships and what kind of things can be done. But the effort needs to be made, and that's the norm. That's just got to be normal Jewish living. That's just the way we are. There's one other thing that it's perhaps also important to remember before Rosh Hashanah. That will help us come through with a little bit more confidence. The Gemara in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Kaf Zayin Amud Beis. Tanu Rabbonin, Maise Bechosid Echod Shepodo Ribo Achas Bas Yisrael. There was a certain chosid, a certain righteous man who redeemed a captured young girl. A young Jewish girl was kidnapped, and he redeemed her. He went and got the money together for the ransom, and he went and he got her out. Obviously he got her out, or apparently he got her out at night time, and came back to the yeshiva with the girl in the middle of the night. V'lamaloin hishkivo tachas margaloisov. Came to the yeshiva and he gave her a bed to sleep in his room. Can you imagine what would go on in Johannesburg if such a thing happened? Lemocha yorad v'tova. The next morning, he got up and he went to the mikveh before davening. V'shonu v'talmidov, and then he gave his shir. Looked very suspicious. V'yom Elohim, and he said to them, tell me, he said to his talmidim, b'shor shehishkavtio tachas margeloisai. I'm not asking you whether you suspected anything. I'm asking you, what did you suspect when you saw me coming home at night and bringing her and taking her into my room? What did you think? It's very simple. He said, we assumed that you came back and that you were dissatisfied with the integrity of one or more of your Talmidim, and you didn't want to just leave her in one of the rooms in the yeshiva. And you felt the safest place for her would be in your own room. That's the only place you would be sure that she wouldn't come to any harm. You knew your Talmidim. There's somebody you're not happy with in the yeshiva. B'shol she'oradati v'tzavalti b'mecher shadatani. So what did you think when I went to the mikveh? So they answer, Shema b'tnei Torah, haderech iro keri l'rebi. Perhaps because of all the traveling, our Rebbe had some tumor, and that's why he went to the mikveh. Omer lehem avoyda kachoya. He says to them, you're absolutely right. That's exactly as it was. V'yatem, and you, k'shem shedantuni l'kaf z'chus, in the same way as you judged me l'kaf z'chus, ha'mokrim yodin eschen l'kaf z'chus, may the Ribbono shel Olam also judge you meritoriously, assuming that your intentions were good. Then the Gemara brings a second very similar episode, with the same conclusion, k'shem shedantuni l'chus, ha'mokrim yodin eschen l'chus. We have a principle which is stated in the first parak of Pirkei Avos that Hevedan kol odom lekaf zchus. One has to judge people lekaf zchus. By the way, one has to be careful with that, because that doesn't mean that one has to be naive and idiotic. One has to judge people lekaf zchus, depends what and when, but talking generally. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz asks on this Gemara, and he says, all very well that a human being is instructed to judge the kapskus. A man does something and you don't know why he did it. That looks very peculiar what he did. comes home in the middle of the night, the Rosh Yeshiva comes with a young girl, and in the two of them go to his room. Okay, they don't lock the door, there's no yichud. There are other people in the building walking around, there's no yichud. But still, you know, funny place for him to take it. Comes out the next morning, goes to the mikveh. Dan lekafchus. Says Chaim Shmuel Levitz, I understand that. But the Ribbono Shel Olam judging the kafchus, what does that mean? Doesn't God know why we really did and what we really did? He doesn't have to assume our good intentions. He knows when it is good, he'll judge us good. When it isn't good, he'll judge us for bad. What does it mean that the Ribbono Shel Olam in our actions will judge us lekafchus? And he answers it to the Gemara, which he doesn't bring, but it's a Gemara which is based on the principle which he develops, that the tzaddikim yetzirah tov shoftim. The Gemara in Brochas, the tzaddikim are motivated by the yetzirah tov. Rishoyim yetzir hara shoftim. Rishoyim, it's the yetzir hara that motivates them. The yetzir hara. Beinonim, ordinary people, by the way, we're not Beinonim. When the Gemara talks about Beinonim, when the Gemara talks about ordinary people, it's talking about ordinary people in Rabbi Akiva's generation. Beinonim, both of them. Yetzir hara and yetzirah tov shoftim. Both of them together. But Chaim says that in every action, as long as we're human beings made of body and soul together, in every action there's going to be of a beinoni. In every action there's going to be a little bit of good and a little bit of bad. It's not really feasible for us to do anything. And I'm saying beinoni again, I don't think that he says that, but it seems clear from that Gemara. A tzaddik can do something 100% with no bad involvement at all, with no bad thought, with no bad motivation. A rosha can hardly do anything with any good motivation. Even the mitzvahs he does for other reasons. But the beinoni, the ordinary man, it's a mixture of both. More of one, more of the other. But in every mitzvah he does, there's a little tiny deep touch, like we were discussing even with Odom HaRishon, how deep, deep down there can be something wrong. Deep down, even in our mitzvahs, there are things which aren't quite right. And even in our averas, deep down there are things which are good. Even in the worst things that we do, if we're beinonim, if we're basically beinonim and not rishoyim, even in the worst things that we do, there's something a little good. We don't do it completely callously, only for the wrong and for the evil and for the negative effects. There's something something lishmo. We justify it with something we find in it, which we think is good and justified. When we talk about the Ribbono Shel Olam judging the kafchus, that's what we mean. That the Ribbono Shel Olam will look at our mitzvahs, and he won't pick on the bad part of them. Because there is, even in our mitzvahs, the Ribbono Shel Olam could pick on every one of our mitzvahs, and he could destroy them, he could annihilate us. Even our mitzvahs he could take, and he could take them one by one, and show us how deep down at the bottom of every mitzvah we did, there was something negative, there was something wrong. And he could throw that mitzvah out, and throw the next mitzvah out, and throw the next mitzvah out. So he wishes his Talmidim, the same as you have judged me lekafchus, you've understood what I did. So may the Ribbono Shel Olam, when he looks at your mitzvahs, look at them with an understanding of the good side of them, and ignore the fact that in every mitzvah there's something a little bit negative. And when he looks at your averas, may he realize in judging you, may he reduce the severity of the crime a little bit, at least, by the fact that deep down, there's something good in you. You didn't do it deliberately, just as an act of rebellion against the Ribbono Shel Olam. And I think that's a very important principle to be adopting now, and to undertake to adopt. Not just to adopt, but to undertake to adopt. That in our viewing of what others do, as far as possible, we don't adopt the tendency of always destroying it by pointing out the negative. You can take any human being who's a beinoni, and he can do the most heroic of actions, and you can reduce it to nothing. You know why he did it? He knew there was a press reporter there. You know why he did it? His girlfriend was watching. You know why he did it? Always find something. Why he did it. Always a something. Just to reduce it to being less than it really was. One can do it. God can do that too with each of us. He can go through each one of our mitzvahs and show that it's nothing. But he doesn't. At least we hope he doesn't. If we judge people lekaf zechus, if when a person has done something great, we say that was wonderful, that was great. and we ignore and we neglect any tiny negative element that there might have been, then the Ribbono Shel Olam responds to us in the same way on Rosh Hashanah. And he looks at our good actions independently of anything negative that there might have been. And with these few ideas, we can face Rosh Hashanah a lot more confidently. The fears of misuse of the power of speech is a very real and a very frightening fear. But it can be counteracted by as much correct use of the power of speech as possible. The fear of speech mustn't drive one into a state of being frozen and not wanting to speak at all. The fear of speech has to drive one into speaking as much as one can, positively, nicely, refinedly, correctly. The fear of actions, that every action we do, there could be something wrong with. True, but how great are some of the positive actions that we do? So it's right, we must do tshuva and all the rest of it, but that's not enough. We've got to pile the positive side with acts of chesed, with acts of kindness, with acts of care, with acts of concern, with acts of tzedakah. And thirdly and finally, one has to be able to look at people, and one has to be able to judge them. Lekas tuchus. One has to be able to see, look at the good things they have done and see them for what they are, and not try and reduce them to nothingness and to reduce them to something that is unimportant and insignificant. And therefore I say to you, on this last of our shiurim this year, that one is particularly susceptible to that kind of interpretation in any position of leadership, as I'm sure you've all found in your own careers and in your own homes. Whether it's your children who look at something that you've done good when they're in a temper and say, but you only did it because, or whether it's in your careers, the people whom you're responsible for, whether it's sometimes the consequences of success when you've done something successfully that bothers people sometimes who have not been as successful, and the tendency is to look at what you've done and to say, well, and why do you think you did it? And obviously this is something which one has to be careful of, and something which I feel very strongly about in a personal sense, that, as we've said, a Beinoni, an ordinary person, there's nothing he can do which he can frankly say is 100% L'shem Shemayim. We're just not 100% people. We don't keep 100% kosher homes. We don't run 100% kosher lives. We don't talk 100% kosher, and we don't do anything 100%. That's one of the consequences of Adam HaRishon. The ability to disobey God has resulted in the fact that we find ourselves disobeying Him in everything we do, just a little bit here and there, if not in major areas. So no human being can get up and say with integrity that what I do is 100% L'shem Shemayim. And that therefore I certainly would not have the chutzpah to say that what I do is 100% L'shem Shemayim. Who knows? One doesn't know. 100% is a big word. But certainly I do say to you that as far as I know and able to do, it is L'shem Shemayim. And that, as I said earlier also, anything which might have been painful or distasteful to you was also done as far as possible L'shem Shemayim. And while it might make things very comfortable for you if you feel yourselves at any stage during the past year or years of having been hurt or humiliated by myself at any time or damaged in any other way, while it might be comfortable for you to say to yourself, who cares, he's only doing it for A, B or C reason, that's not the way to look at things, and that's not the way to reduce things, and that's not the way to judge people. The way to judge people is as far as possible the kaps chus, to understand that as far as they are able to, if they're basically sincere human beings, sure, there might be touches of subconscious shaloi l'shem shemayim, who knows, but as far as they are able to, as far as you are able to, and as far as any ordinary person is able to, it's L'shem Shemayim. And by viewing things in that way, with that kind of positive attitude and with that kind of understanding, the Ribbono Shel Olam in his turn will view us L'kaf S'chus, and will go through the list of every Avera we've done, and he'll say, but in every Avera, you know, there was something good in it. And he'll go through every mitzvah we've done, completely neglecting the areas of those mitzvahs which weren't 100% L'shem Shemayim, so as to assist us to build up that account, to build up that balance, so that we can stand with confidence on Rosh Hashanah and enjoy our Rosh Hashanah, communicate with the Ribbono Shel Olam and have a Yom Tov and a good Yom Tov, experience a good Aseres Yemei Tshuva, which Yemei Tzashim will all become the beginning of a very good and a happy new year. the sleepless period starts from tonight. So we will be starting here at 11:30. The form will be that I'll give a short shir before slichus, and at about 12 o'clock we'll say the slichus, which I guess will take about 45 minutes, and thereafter they'll be said every morning before the davening.